Hi, everybody. This is Nate. I've got a fun discussion for you today. We are talking about framing. We're going to cover some of the common questions and comments that are recurring in our Spec House series under the sort of first several framing episodes. The point is to add some clarification on some of those recurring items. I hope you enjoy it. There's really a wide range of topics here. We talk about math. We're talking about some of the tools. We talk about the materials and why there's no screws versus nails, and how quickly it happens in real life versus in the video series. I hope you enjoy it. We are feeling a lot of relief because in actuality, the framing is done at this point. We have it behind us. Now we just got to get the videos out, but you may be able to sense that we both are feeling a little excitement, I guess, is the best word to describe it, because we've kind of passed this milestone. It feels good to have it behind us, and we're really pleased with the way it turned out. I hope you enjoy this discussion. A handful of viewers asked why there's no screws holding the walls together.
Why not screw it together?
Yeah, it's been 100% nails. So what's the answer there?
A couple of those questions were, why not screws and glue? So I don't know if this is a complete answer, but a couple of other comments, in fact, several have been sort of in response to some people saying that that framework looked light and it looked weak and it looked pathetic or whatever compared perhaps to European construction, is that these wooden frame buildings are very dynamic. They resist earthquakes really well, like really well. They will stand there and they'll move and they flex a little bit and they tend to remain more viable than a more rigid structure. So if you've ever tried to break off a bent screw versus a bent nail, you know, if it gets bent somehow and you can't remove it, if you try to break it off, a screw, even a GRK, even a good screw, but especially a drywall screw, if you bend it twice, three times max, it snaps off. But a nail, you've got to go back and forth maybe a dozen times, maybe 20 times to fatigue that metal enough that it'll break. And the reason for that is that a nail is it's a lower carbon steel and it's not hardened to the same extent that a screw is. A screw is hard, and hard means brittle, and so a screw would, in a dynamic situation, it could break. Now, it'll hold tighter. You know, it probably exerts a steadier clamping action, and it's plenty hard, but it's probably, I don't know, but I would say that it would be at least four times more labor to screw walls together, even with the modern impact drivers, than to just nail them with a nail gun. Heck, maybe five or six times. Yeah. So it drives cost up. And I don't think that structurally, for what a nail does in creating a diaphragm that's hard but not breakable, I think maybe a screw just wouldn't work. And that's a guess. But there has to be a real reason, because it is never, 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 never done. And the engineer doesn't specify that you screw your shear panel. He specifies that you nail your shear panel, and he specifies a nail size. So it just doesn't work.
Nails are crazy strong in the right direction. And if you put a nail straight up into a piece of wood, it could pull itself straight back out. So that would be the kryptonite, the weak.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about of nails, gravity helping them, and it's just they are so tough.
Yeah,
and so there's no downside to nails.
That's right. It's a resistance difference in strength. Screws have huge resistance to draw out.
Yes.
Nails have no resistance to draw out. Screws have only a momentary resistance to shear, and a nail has a long-term hard resistance to ongoing shear.
Probably the most correct answer is the cost, though, all things considered, from the cost of buying them to how quickly they are installed to how many of them your nail gun can hold at a time. I mean, just in every single way, nails are faster, which translates to less expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a good question from someone who's not used to seeing wood frame construction, because they're already thinking like, whoa, what is going on? So fair question.
Okay. And not only is it fair from an intuitive standpoint, but I watched a video the other night on a structure being assembled in Germany, and these big long rafters came machine pre-cut. bird's mm-hmm. mouths, pre-cut, perfect, plum cuts, fit, sized. And they were running them up and using a big, long structural screw that was pre-started. I don't know if it was just started on the ground or at the shop, at exactly the right place to run clear through the width of the rafter and drive into the beam at the bird's mouth.
Oh,
so that roof system was screwed on, but it was more of a lag bolt than a screw.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, and I think of big screws and small screws as kind of totally different animals because small screws that might be comparable with a nail are nothing like a big structural screw.
That's right.
Which is a thousandfold of either one of them. Yeah. It's a whole different animal.
In fact, structural screws have recently made an appearance here. Instead of an A35 or a Hurricane clip holding a rafter to a top plate, now we can take, Simpson makes a structural screw about that long that you can screw up through the bottom of the top plate or the beam up into the rafter and hold it down.
Yeah.
So it happens here, but just not with studs, not in walls.
Now let's talk about the speed component, which we addressed in one of the videos. And it is interesting how fast these homes can be framed, number one. Number two, how not fast our house was framed, both from the video standpoint and from compared to production framing. Now, for the listeners, production framing, well, why don't you define that for the listeners?
So a production framing is an approach to framing large numbers of houses that are exactly the same. It's a mass production approach, and the basis of it is that you have different crews of people who specialize in different segments of the framing, and it's broken down. And you know, maybe you've heard me talk about this, but the piecework framing model in southwestern United States has, never mind the fact that a concrete company does a concrete and nothing to do with the wood frame, but one guy will snap the wall lines, another team will cut the plates, top and bottom plate. The first guy who snapped it comes back and does the detailing. Another crew comes in and nails the walls together and stands them up. Another couple of guys come in and do the plumbing line. Two or three other guys come in and put on the joist or stack. It's just, it is, you get the
division of labor.
The division of labor and economics of scale, because there are so many of these things to be done. Now you can divide labor and you have a little guy's little crews. All, they're independent contractors almost, but they're functioning as employees of the framing company. And they just get so efficient. And the employer does not take responsibility for what they are doing with their time when they're not doing his little tract. And so they wander off and have an employment agreement with another framer somewhere else and do their specialty somewhere else. And brother, it's fast.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I've never actually been on a production site, but I have seen subdivisions get thrown together in like a month. And they just like grow out of the ground like weeds. It's like bang, bang, bang. And all of a sudden there's a roof and siding on it. And it's nuts. And that is not what we have going on. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, I would say most custom houses are, well, we're not unique among all houses. We're more in line with a custom house where every single part is kind of being invented and created and solved for the very first time.
And only time.
And only time. If we were going to build 18 of these houses, I guarantee you the 15th one would be pretty quick.
Yeah, that's right. So let me hang on that for just a second. So I did work in a production framing environment for not a long time, 4 years, I guess, and specialized pretty much in stacking. And
just describe again stacking. Just in
stacking. Stacking is the term for putting the roof system on a house. Whether it is hand stacked, that is, you're cutting the rafters, you know, conventional cut, that's cut and stack, hand stacking, or rolling and blocking and backing trusses. I would come in there and I had two guys hired, although we were all employees of the same framing companies. I had an agreement with the framing company as to what the split would be on the piece price. When I was providing the management and took responsibility for the stacking, the net piece price that they had in their books for stacking the house would be mine to distribute between me and my two employees on whatever basis I had made the agreement with them. Mm-hmm. And so we would do one and a half roof systems per day. Every day we would either, what didn't matter what it was, we got it down to where we were doing one to one and a half per day. In one tract, we did 164 houses in one tract in 1 year. Just in one tract. And there were two or three other tracts we were working out of. So that was very much a production framing basis of work?
Some trades, I'm thinking of masonry, has events that are athletic events. They're races where they'll have like a contest of which mason and his hod can build this little wall segment the fastest. And there's a bleachers with fans cheering, and it's really cool. You can watch them online. I watched one when I was doing that big block wall cool. a couple years ago. I was like, I really had my head into masonry, and I watched some of that. Mm-hmm. And masonry is a trade that where that it's really conducive to that, because you can say, like, you know, build this 6 foot tall by 6 foot wide wall, mark set, go, bang. Mm-hmm. And then you can see who's the fastest. So how do you think, if framing was that type of thing in your prime, and maybe not so much you in particular, but just in general, was there a competition aspect to how quickly the framing kind of got done, or was everybody so far apart that it was hard to tell how much people got done anyways?
The competition aspect was that if you fell behind, if there was any more than two or three houses ahead of you in the track that were waiting on what your specialty was, they would bring in another crew. Another crew would show up looking for some stack or for some frame, and the job foreman would say, yeah, I've got a slab over there you can jump on. Mm-hmm. And so the guys that were there working were very motivated to make sure that they were keeping up, mm-hmm. regardless of how hard they had to work or how late they had to work. They did not want any work laying there undone. So that was part of the competition, was against the guys you didn't know yet, but you thought yeah. could drive in at any second. So I was just thinking about my claim of doing 1.5 houses a day. That wasn't right. At one point, I had three guys working for me in that tract, and we split into two teams of two, because that's the ideal size for a stacking crew, is two guys. And then it became this competition between Bob and I can't remember his name, and Robert and I. And it was terrific, because Bob was a competitive guy, and it took him about 3 months to realize, wait a minute, even when I win, you win. I said, yeah, kind of. But he never won. Okay, I could always stay ahead of him. But there's nothing like turning your work into a little bit of a friendly race. It's just,
and even in a
cool.
housing track, that, you know, I was thinking you're kind of far away from the other guy in the other roof, but in some ways that's great, because you can tell when he gets off that roof and gets in his truck and goes to the next house, mm-hmm. and he's done, mm-hmm. and you're kind of like, oh man, I've still got to do the next 20 feet of roof
that's
here,
right.
And so I guess even though you're far away, it's plain as day when you get behind.
And not only that, but there's the nasty tricks you can play about, you know, getting to the forklift operator so he stocks your job first, and making sure that you've got all your blocks prepped properly, and you know, maybe you buy the forklift operator lunch or bring him a soda, so you're getting preferential treatment. Now you're getting ahead of him because of your relationship, and so, you know, there's all those games.
I've heard you say a lot of times, and I know for you this is undeniable, but I want to talk about math a little bit, and you've always been very vocal of math being such a kind of superpower. And again, I know for you and a framing it is, but why don't you talk about that a little bit? I know from just working around you that you're doing math in your head instantly and quickly, and that translates instantly to productivity. So for a framer, that is the case, but talk about that a little bit. And is that just kind of something you learn when you're doing framing, or are there some framers who kind of never get it, or is it something that anybody can pick up, or how do you get into that a little bit?
Okay. Haven't really thought of it in those terms. So to go clear to the extreme math end of the scale, I just met a guy through the channel, Steve Ellis. I've mentioned him on one or two videos, I think. That guy has taken application of math in carpentry about as far as you can take it. He loves it. He has pushed the boundaries to where he really understands, you know, the square, the framing square depends. The numbers on the framing square were derived to a great extent using the trigonometric function tangent and its inverse secant. Okay, now I know that, and I used to play with that a little bit just to kind of be able to understand it a little bit and mystify my friends, but he really gets it, and he can bust that out and apply that in different places, and he uses ratio and proportion a lot effectively, and I mean, that's impressive and it's useful. On the other hand, John Urban, who took me as a partner pieceworking, who, hard guy, super productive, really understood framing beautifully. He dealt with the numbers enough to get the work done. Mm-hmm. He was much more invested in making jigs and snapping out full-size renderings of a roof section or something on a piece of concrete or floor in order to get dimensions directly like that. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the answer to your question is that it's like every other tool. It's a great tool, but it's not the answer to every single question.
Yeah.
But the more facility you have with numbers and math and construction, the more opportunities for promotion you end up getting. That's why engineers occupy the top management slots, because they can manipulate numbers.
Yeah.
And it just gives you this range of options.
That answers one of the things I just never got. I always imagined that geometry and algebra, I could visualize how those translated to a more productive worker and just real world, you know, competence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I never understood how trigonometry, I guess calculus for an engineer, but you're saying in roof cutting, trigonometry and all of those sine cosines things are showing up.
They have shown up in the square. The square is a shortcut to all that.
Okay.
But then if you have that additionally,
yeah,
it continues to be available to you. Even if you are not familiar with how it's applied on the square,
yeah,
if that makes sense. But it really shows up in building layout, because surveyors, that's their world. Trigonometry is the world of the surveyor.
Oh.
Okay, that is how the West, that's how the world was put on maps, is using trigonometry. Line of sight, instrumentation, measuring the distance, calculating the angle. It's trigonometry is surveying, and surveying is trigonometry.
Oh, wow.
And that can shrink back. A good concrete layout man can set up an instrument, transit, also known as theodolite. Okay, now that's a highbrow, that's the highbrow noun for a transit, okay, is theodolite. And I think it probably speaks to a degree of accuracy or something. I don't know. But you can take shots, and if you have a man out, you can take shots and locate points in a parking lot and verify points and reestablish points that got knocked out. If you can do trigonometry and you've got an instrument and a tape measure, that can all be reestablished.
Mm-hmm.
And a carpenter, even just a middling, even somebody like me who used some math but not all the math, it was a real advantage sometimes.
I can't help but think of math as the way it was divided in school. You know, like I've already said, geometry and trig and calculus and algebra, but it's math is math. It's all kind of the same interlocking rules,
yeah,
and laws, and we've kind of divided it into these, mm-hmm, little compartments. And so, uh-huh, it's, I guess it's probably a little foolish to act like this math is important and that math is not. It's all kind of the same animal, and it's how deep you want to get.
It is. And I didn't get that deep. So I went to Oregon State for two whole terms before I decided I was going to be a musician. And I washed out of calculus, washed out, mm-hmm, because my algebra skills were not strong enough to solve the differentiation and those things. And I thought, man, I got to take a W here or I'm going to flunk. And I just couldn't stand that. And
yeah.
So
did you ever take a statistics class or like learn anything about stats?
Never learned a lick about statistics.
I'm pretty terrible at math. I did take stats and barely like scrape through it, skin of my teeth. But I remember really enjoying it in terms of a math class that really truly has like real world, you know, evidence or it shows application. It shows up all the time in the problems we were solving in stats that I was kind of like, holy smokes, math just became like 3D and I get it. And I'm always kind of, it's strange to me that statistics is not more of like that's not introduced at a younger age, because it seemed so much more interesting, at least to me.
Interesting. That isn't. Yeah. I've never turned a page in a statistics text.
And that seems like a math skill that could translate to real world power, or at least, I don't know, something, you know, understanding how groups of people might, you know, reading surveys and conducting surveys and then being able to translate, okay, if this many people answered this on the survey, well, that would mean, therefore, if I do this among this, I can expect these results.
Uh-huh,
I mean,
that
seems like that could be some lucrative, you know, information.
So math applied to people instead of just to numbers or just to space.
At least that's what I came away with. It. And again, I barely scraped through, so I could be way off. But
interesting.
All right. Next topic I've got on my punch list here is Larry Hahn. And we made a little segment about Larry in one of these videos. I don't know if you've said everything there is to say about it, but talk about striking a chord. I mean, everybody loves that guy. I don't think I've ever heard or read or even sensed a single
criticism
of him everywhere. Yeah. And all I could do is nod my head in agreement and say, Larry Hahn's the man.
Larry Hahn is the man. I would have loved to have worked with him. For instance, getting back to the math thing, I wonder how often he crunched numbers. I mean, he used the blue rafter cutting book, right? I think that's the book that he used. And that's got it all spit out in there. And that's not to take anything away from him. I wonder how much he relied on numbers and how much he had worked kind of end around more hands-on fixes. But he just, economy of motion, understood allowable tolerances. Yeah. He could drive a nail just exactly like everybody wants to.
Yeah.
He and his brother were just such a well-oiled team. You could just tell that they could, when they were doing that job, you could just tell. They could talk about the work or they could talk about anything else and the work would move forward at the same rate.
Yeah.
You know, I love his brother wore that funny little hat.
I know.
It is so, who in the world would wear a hat like that on job site? Well, by golly, Johan would, you know. And he would shut you up with how much work he produced at the end of the day.
Yeah, both of them. I mean, those red suspenders, you can't look at anybody's carpenter bags with red suspenders and not be like, aha, you're a Larry Hahn fan.
Yeah.
And in general, the guy, I think to some extent, just the shape of him, those spindly legs and his skinny jeans. I mean, everything about him is it's not classic or iconic. It's just Larry Hahn. Just and it's Larry part Hahn. Of what, like, just made the kind of the magic there. Like, just what a neat
guy.
What a neat guy.
And you know, I bet if anybody actually knew, but framing. So I'm guessing he was framing production framing through the 60s and into the 70s was probably coming into his heyday. You know, and just kind of peeking out in the 80s in the Northern California Bay Area. If I get that right,
I'm not sure.
I'll bet he made money.
Okay, probably.
I'll bet that guy deposited money every single week. You know, you can't get those systems down and be that efficient in an economy growing like that, where real estate was appreciating at a rate that is a joke on any kind of a rational basis without having made money in a blue collar gig.
Yeah, that's a good point. That may have been some sort of golden age for framers with skills, where they could make money that would make a dentist kind of like give them a thumbs up after a day's work. You know, I don't know, but I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
He has such a funny and enjoyable way of talking that it comes across as humble, and I'm sure it is humble, but it's just like a beautiful simplicity, you know?
Yeah, he is.
I nailed the rim board through the floor joist with two 8-penny nails. That's the code.
Yeah, that's the code, and I had to hit it twice to do it.
Yeah. It's really cool. We ought to check around and see. I assume he has family. I wonder if he's got kids around. And
that's interesting.
It would be pretty neat to chase him down.
Yeah, because I guess he retired, right, and moved to Coos Bay.
Yeah, Coos Bay.
He left California.
It's not far from here for listeners. That's probably an hour and a half. Although that doesn't necessarily mean his whole family's came with him there. But
we ought to do a little checking on that.
Hey, listeners, if one of you is a detective, see if you can track down some sort of a Hahn family. And it'd be really fun to hear some stories about him that hopefully back up all of our expectations about him.
Yeah. You know, so Benjamin Franklin said something to the effect that there's only, how did he say it? That there's only two ways to be remembered after you die. And one is to write a book worth reading or to live a life worth writing about.
Okay. Oh.
So just think of Larry Hahn.
Yeah.
Just a hard-charging piecework framer on the California coast, and he wrote books.
Oh, other books?
Well, the Very Efficient Carpenter and one or two others,
right,
that are worth reading.
Yeah.
And he lived a life that was apparently worth documenting on film. I mean, attaboy Larry, you know?
Yeah, you know, in this day and age, like with us, it's very easy to put out video content because I grab my phone and we can pretty much do it instantly, but...
Yeah.
That took putting that series together and convincing whatever producer to do it. Like, you know, you just wonder how that all happened. Yeah. And that probably speaks to his personality and competence as well.
Because
even like today, there's a lot of skilled framers and all these people, but but it's hard to get really skilled at that and also then, you know, write a book.
Yeah. Yeah.
and so anyways,
yeah,
a neat guy, well deserving of all the praise and adoration and yeah. Yeah, big fan.
Yeah. All right.
That guy did have some skinny legs, though. Jeez Louise. I just clicked it on for a minute, and it's like, yeah. Man, those are just like a daddy long leg.
Yeah, but he put his feet in 8-inch top mock toe lace up boots, yeah. Maybe, you know, and he wore them out, you know?
Oh, you could just tell. I mean, and it's not like a diss. It's more just like this guy is lean
yeah.
and efficient
yeah.
and probably strong as heck.
Yeah, yeah.
And can probably run across roof rafters like yep. a cat.
That's right. That's right. And when a guy like that is 20 years old, he can grab the top plate. He was tall enough to probably reach up and grab an 8-foot top plate and pull himself up there, whether there was a block in the wall or not.
Yeah.
You know, he could just get there.
Yeah.
And if he needed to get down, probably until he was 30, he could have jumped.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it takes to be productive, is you got to be athletic that way.
It reminds me of when you see like a I don't want to say a wrestler, but like an MMA guy or a fighter, somebody with a body shape that's kind of like, oh, wow, yeah, makes sense. You, yeah. you are built for that. And he looks yeah. just like a guy who was built to yeah. frame houses. Even the fact that his glasses make him look kind of smart and intelligent and just everything about him.
Everything about him.
So,
yeah.
All right, enough on Larry Han Solo. All right. So what's up with knee pads? No, I'm not asking you. I'm asking everybody's and lots of comments about why aren't you wearing knee pads? Have you ever seen somebody wear knee pads while they're framing a house?
Never.
I don't get
never.
It.
You would be laughed out of the trap.
I know.
And they would be throwing rocks at you as you hightailed it to your truck, man. Now, carpet layers, tile layers,
yeah.
concrete finishers, man, put those knee pads on.
Yeah.
But a framer, now, so here's what I have to acknowledge. Being old now, back hurting now, I can't just bend at the waist and do the layout down at my ankles. I have to get down on a knee or two.
Yeah.
And so in the videos, I'm down there all the time and people think, oh my gosh, you're going to hurt your knees. You're going to hurt your knees. But a young man in good shape, you're not on your knees that much.
And even when you are on your knees on a smooth
That's right.
plywood deck.
That's right.
You're not kneeling on gravel.
That's right.
I mean, you are in the concrete. So that's maybe a different story. But in framing, I don't know if knee pads make sense.
They make no sense at all. You're climbing. Framing is about climbing.
Yeah.
You know, and who's want to wear... Yeah, no, thank you. Now, these pants, my pants, which Carhartt has discontinued these pants, right?
Yeah.
I just can't believe you would do that, Carhartt. Just saying. But these are made so that if you want to, you can slip a pad in that'll just be in the pants all the time. Now, that makes some sense.
Yeah, I think somebody mailed you some.
They mailed me some. And just to show you how urgent it is, I haven't put them in yet. Sorry. But
yeah, well, it just shows how much it's not an issue. So mm-hmm. for those of you who don't get that, well, and I do get it, because when you're at home and you're kind of doing work for the fun of it, like, it's really comfy to put on knee pads.
Oh, yeah.
I actually, when I can make it happen and I see them and I'm going to be on my knees, it's like this beautiful luxury.
Mm-hmm.
But the times when all those stars line up where the knee pads are like within arm's reach and I know I'm going to be on my knees for a long time, mm-hmm. it's a little bit few and far between.
Okay, now, staying on this, so the construction culture that I came of age in and then moved away from to Las Vegas when I was, from Las Vegas to here when I was 35 or 36, has changed so much now with this incessant attention to personal protective equipment.
Yeah.
That just was not the case. It was not the case, for better or for worse. And so, I don't know, now maybe on, at least for big corporate construction efforts, maybe they issue their framers knee pads. I don't know. But
yeah.
But in the tracks, when you're getting paid by how much work you produce, nobody's going to have those on.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess like everything else, it's possible there's somebody who wears them on a daily basis who is a framer who could say, I love them. And yeah. Fair
wrong.
Enough.
Yeah, wrong, you know, man. I'm wrong. You know,
well, for them, they're right. For them, it works and that makes sense to them. And so go yeah. for it.
Yeah.
There's really something to that where it's just like a human instinct where when you do something and it works for you, it's really hard to
yeah.
let go of it and totally embrace another way and say, I was wrong for 8 years. This is not just about knee pads, just in general.
Everything,
it's
yeah.
about everything. And, yeah. and who knows, maybe there's something we're not getting there.
Yeah.
All right. We did also mention in one of those videos of that framing with lumber is very standard for around here. And in a lot of places in the world, brick and concrete are the standard even for affordable homes. And I just saw a comment a few minutes ago. Someone said something to the effect of, wow, I've never seen wood that nice. And that made me consider that for some of these other countries who aren't used to seeing it, that could be one reason why it's so strange to see a whole house built of lumber. Maybe the lumber they're used to seeing really is that ratty that it doesn't make sense, because we have had a lot of really nice lumber on this site. Some of the beams, we almost wanted to just stop everything, go get the camera and talk about how nice the wood is. So that maybe didn't get emphasized, that it's possible that some of these countries aren't having the same beautiful lumber to work with that we do. If they did, they might feel different.
I'm sure that any of the, in fact, a comment I just read that in Great Britain, building with wood was very commonplace until the 1500s. By then, they had deforested the island. And for a while, there were laws in place that cutting down a tree without permission of the king was punishable by death. And now their forests are kind of reclaiming the ground a little bit, and probably enough Douglas County, Oregon lumber is making its way over to Great Britain that they're building with it a little more now. Yeah. But you use what you've got. I mean, think of the pioneers coming west, sod houses. You know, you got dirt, you got grass. We cut turves out of sod and grass and stack it up and make a house out of that.
Yeah.
You use what you've got. And around here, we've had lumber.
Yeah, that's right. I do think concrete and brick houses just make so much sense. And it's, I wish we could afford it. It'd be nice if we could only build 500-year houses out of that. But around here, it's hard to imagine anybody doing that just because of the cost.
Nobody here makes bricks. There is no brick manufacturing here. I don't know if that's because of the type of the soil or just the fact that we had lumber. Now, you get down into Utah, Intermountain West, there's bricks, lots of brick facade houses and some actual brick houses. And I don't know where else you would go to find that, but not on the West Coast, Northwest anyway.
Yeah, and just so the listeners know, it's not in any way that you're opposed to concrete. And if you've been around long enough, you may have heard us or heard a video talking about concrete being your, if not favorite, but certainly the most versatile building material there is. So they are absolutely right that concrete is the bomb.
It is. You can't beat concrete, but concrete is here anyway, just plain more money. That's it. And houses are almost always being paid for with a mortgage, and the mortgage is always just as big as people can possibly stand. And so it just the economics of being human, that in order to get more living space in your house, you're going to buy or build or have a wood frame house on the West Coast, just the way it works.
Yeah, this affordability concept is really complex, because people will also be disappointed at cheap craftsmanship or cheap built production framed houses, and certainly manufactured homes get this rap of, you know, junk, I can never live there, and all that's fine. At the same time, people have to live somewhere and they have to be able to afford it. And like all, you know, quality, price, speed, all that, there is a need for affordable houses, wood frame, manufactured home, all these things kind of fill that and create housing for people who can't afford something fancier. And that there's nothing dishonorable about that.
No, there's not. I mean, there's this wide spectrum of automobiles, right? I mean, you got Geos on one end and you have Ferraris.
I think Geo's long gone.
Oh, okay. Well, whoever's occupying that niche, Hyundai still around?
Yeah, but actually, I think they're pretty decent.
Okay, but I mean, so what's the bottom feeder? What is the least quality conscious?
Kia, maybe?
Kia. Okay, so you got Kia on one end of the spectrum, and you got, I mean, Ferrari or Rolls or whoever it is on the other side, and not everybody is going to choose those.
Yeah.
But given a choice, you're going to tend towards the nicer side of the scale if you can. But if you can't, you still have to get from point A to point B, and so that is why there are so many manufactured homes with families in them.
Yeah.
And then the next step up would be so many production-built tract homes with families in them.
Yeah.
And, you know, right on up.
One point we didn't mention about wood-framed homes, and this really is an advantage, is how easy it is to repair, modify, add on. you can very easily kind of modify your home if it's built with wood. And I would think a brick home, a concrete home is a little different story. You know, adding a window is going to be a little tougher.
Yeah, I know what it is with concrete. And so the small interactions I've had remodeling homes that include brick is you can never match the color. The color cannot be matched. And so anything you do on the outside of a brick home is always going to show up as a remodel, a repair, an addition. Now, that's a downside.
Yeah, that is. All right, next topic. These first handful of framing episodes, you were using that new Plum rigging axe, that the red-handled hammer axe that was given to you by a fan, Dave Taylor.
Dave Taylor.
In New Mexico, another old school, really brainy.
That's right.
Probably a human calculator himself.
Yeah.
And he used one of those when he was framing, as did you. Our viewers may be surprised to see that for a lot of the rest of the house, you're not really using that as much. Mm-hmm. How come?
I love a nail gun. Okay, so I bought my first nail gun when I was piecing with my rigging axe. So I had the rigging axe when I started and then bought the nail gun partway in. So the habit was established. You know, it was what I knew and was used to. But now, hammering's great and it has its place. But for me, the nail gun puts in the bulk of the nails and the stiletto sets them. And besides that, the rigging axe was a beautiful and is still a beautiful thing below your waist. You know, in a heavy blow, driving a partition over, but nailing those nails below your waist, which could include nailing eave blocks in when you're walking down the plate, nailing the trusses down. But as soon as you come up above your waist, gravity's no longer your friend with that hammer blow. And so the advantage of that heavy, weight forward, nail driving machine is dissipated, and you might as well use something that's not going to wear you out.
Yeah. So you, you're using the stiletto as a hammer, like we've said in videos. A nail gun never obviates a hammer. Mm-hmm. But even just from hammers, you switched at some point there back to the stiletto as opposed to the rigging axe. Yeah. Is that just because it's a little easier to carry around?
It is. It's lighter around my waist. It's how much? It's 28. It's 14 ounces. It's almost a pound lighter around my waist.
That's a lot.
It doesn't hang up as much. And I've always got the nail gun in my hand anyway.
Yeah.
So the rigging axe is beautiful when you're driving a lot of big nails below your waist, and that's it.
I get a chuckle, and we mentioned this morning. We filmed a video about, can't remember what it was about, but many of you listeners will know that the word butcher is a common slur used against carpenters, and so it's kind of extra hilarious that some carpenters use that axe. Maybe that's how the term derived.
So can we be honest here? A big part of the reason a carpenter tries an axe the first day is because he just wants to rub people's nose in the fact that, yeah, darn right, I'm a butcher, and here's the proof of it, right?
Yeah.
Call me a butcher if you want, and here's your evidence for it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. It's like one of those when the words just line up, and it's like,
yeah,
you're a butcher, and it's like, and you get caught holding an axe, and you're just like, no, I'm not. It's like, but you're like caught red-handed because you are holding this like butcher's tool.
But so people say, well, I would fire a man if he got out of his truck and had an axe. Really? I mean, so the backside of a claw hammer is two claws for digging nails out of the wood, right?
Yeah.
The backside of an axe is a straight blade. For what? For chopping off nails or breaking bands, and that's it. You almost never use it.
Yeah.
And I guess it's so stereotypical. We all stereotype everybody all the time, right? And so that's part of the costume, that you've got this barbarian thing, but it has nothing to do with the quality of the work you produce. It has everything to do with the tool that you like to handle.
Yeah.
That's it. And people say, oh, it's so dangerous. You know, I just flinched every time you raised the back of that axe up towards your head. When was the last time you or anybody else you know, in the process of just hammering throughout the day, hit themselves with the back of their hammer?
Actually,
I've never done it.
Leo did it about a week ago.
Okay.
It's my six-year-old.
All right. A six-year-old can do it.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't know. It's just funny to me. Now, the other thing I got to clear up, people think it's a roofing hatchet or a Boy Scout hatchet,
yeah,
and it just makes me shudder. It is not that. It is a rigging axe.
Yeah.
And if you had a roofing hatchet next to it, you would see the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway.
And among pros, let's say like top level grade A pros, the axe versus the claw, nobody's bending nails over at that level.
That's
and
right.
If they do, in probably one blow, they can just bury it anyways. They would never turn it over and pull it out in framing, right?
That's right, unless it's in a spot where it's hurting something. And if that's the case, if it's bent over hard, the claws on your hammer may not get to it, and out comes your cat's paw, and you hook it and blast it out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, it's just pulling nails is not why you're in business.
Yeah.
You know? It doesn't make you any money.
And it's just very much one of those personal preference things that people, like sports teams, enjoy probably, you know, bickering about as much as anything else. But definitely cool to have received that from Dave, and probably fun for you to use it there for a few weeks.
Oh, it was. And I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but my plum rigging axe that I used for that long period of time finally blew up. The sides of the head just cracked, crack, 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 from putting handles in and driving the wedge in and abusing it and using it to beat on rebar and other hammers. And it just blew up. It failed. That high carbon steel was exhausted. And I thought, well, that's that. And then Dave Taylor shows up in Arizona with that beautiful, shiny, red-handled thing. And it was a joy.
Where is that original one? It's in the shop somewhere?
I can't find it. I can't believe it. I welded it and I welded it and I welded it. And that's what I did. I bought a newer one and cut the face off of it and welded the face off that old plum on, keeping the temperature down, because every other tool I'd ever had, the waffle marks on the face just wore off, and that plum face was so hard. I loved it. I tried to keep it as long as I could, but they're all gone now.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it was neat.
And it's not just you. Dave knew that the plum rigging axe was the unit, and he hunted those down and found them in a hardware store in the Midwest, like one of those hardware stores that shouldn't be in business anymore.
Yeah.
that had been on the shelf since 1991.
Yeah.
And that was like after a nationwide search, from how I understand it.
Yeah.
And we had a comment or an email from another viewer saying, "Where'd you get that? I've been looking forever for one of those." Yeah. So it's one of those sort of unicorn things, apparently.
It is.
The actual plum rigging axe, and for good reason.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have it. It kind of hurt me to have to go over and take the beautiful red off that handle, but it was just a little too fat.
Yeah.
You know, so I had the belt sander and clamped it down, and it fits great now.
Yeah. All right. The last note I have here, we kind of covered, and that is about production framing reduces the cost for, you know, obviously the contractor and the developer and everybody, but ultimately that trickles down to the people buying the homes, which is a good thing. So all of these production methods and really quick framing, and to some extent, not that the sloppiness can be excused, but man, everybody's pushing costs down together, and it certainly, we would be living in more expensive homes without a lot of these production tricks.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And yeah, there are butchers among us. And yeah, I, on any given day, at any given moment, somebody might look at something that I leave behind me and say, well, that guy's a butcher. Well, I hope that's not true. I hope it's just a judgment call I made that didn't compromise the structure. But it's important to get all the work done that you can. Yeah. And that's where I was going, is that there's some degree of confidence. I mean, the codes and the inspection regimes are painful. That's the code. But the code does ensure a certain minimum standard.
Mm-hmm.
It does ensure a certain at least entry-level certainty of safety, at least. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the code can be circumvented, and there, you know, criminal contractor school is a real institution, right? But with code in place and inspections happening, if that's happening where you live, you don't have to flinch about what is going on behind the drywall or under the siding. It's holding you up. And if there's an earthquake, it's probably going to hold you up as well or better than any other structure around. Mm-hmm. And so those framers that are out there thrashing away are doing an important job, and they deserve some respect, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And like a lot of, interactions, like with a mechanic, you know, I'm imagining a person hiring a framer crew who knows the basics. You know, just knowing the basics, and if you see somebody doing or something a little sloppy, and just kind of letting them know, like, hey, I got an idea here, and this is not plumb, and you kind of check it. Just kind of some of those very basics can help the contractor, the workers know, like, oh, yeah, this is obvious, you know.
See that's a great point. And if some of you who are listening to this are thinking of hiring someone or engaging with a contractor, you do that right off the bat. You bring a tool out there and you you check a little bit of his work, especially around Square, Plumb, and True, mm-hmm. and say, hey, this is not square. You know, can you tell me how are you going to square this up? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that's a little too far out of Plumb, don't you think? I don't think we ought to accept that. Do you? You didn't mean to leave this like that, did you?
Yeah. And
just it kind of puts everybody on notice that I'm not just going to turn over the whole management of this enterprise to you without providing some oversight that's in my best interest.
Man, I got to think that an owner walking around without a word said and just putting a little 4-foot level on several walls and doing that and leaving, would that, you know, that says more than almost any conversation or any letter or any email. And so doing that right off the bat could probably be potentially very valuable.
And if you want to really put teeth in that, have a little notebook with you.
Yeah.
So that they can see you taking that reading and jotting down a note, and you're going to have their undivided attention.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, we got a lot of framing coming up, so I hope that the video series doesn't get boring because, man, there's just a lot coming of this, and yeah. We'll have to see how it goes. I don't think it's going to be boring, but there's just a lot of framing. We're only 3 or 4 episodes in, and there's a lot coming.
And part of that's because we were a 2-man crew.
Yeah,
you know, and it's a complex house. If it would have been 5 guys who were used to working with each other, with one lead man who was calling the shots and the measurements and doing the layout, there would not be as much framing because it all would have happened in much less time.
Yeah.
But the number of calendar days that we worked on it with the camera running generated a ton of footage.
Yeah, but I guess either way, it's the same number of cuts and nails going in, and whether it happened in 3 weeks and the camera, you know, ran 14 hours a day versus the way we did it where it was running. But I guess the point is there's a lot of building that these viewers are going to see. And actually that brings up a point about Larry Hahn and his house. And we both had this reaction. Man, that house looked easy.
Yeah. Yeah. 412 pitch, 2x6 rafters, 8-foot ceilings. I thought, yeah, let me do a video building a house like that.
See, that just further emphasizes how smart Larry Hahn is. He says, yeah, I'm going to do a house, and I'm not going to do some insane 2-story Craftsman overhangy
on a
TJI.
On a postage stamp lot.
Yeah, so that guy, we should have probably taken another page out of his playbook and built a little simpler house.
Yeah.
Too late now. Yeah. All right, thanks for listening. Yeah, anything else to add?
Should we spoil a little bit about the roof system or anything or not?
Go for it. What?
So I'll just say this, that when you see the roof system, you're going to realize there is nothing typical about it. There have not been a lot of roof systems like this built anywhere around here. I can tell you that. First time I've ever done anything quite like this. And I wish I would have had Larry Hahn helping me. It would have been really comforting. But it's in place. It looks great. It's kind of iconic Craftsman. We didn't really intend it to be exactly iconic, but we've survived it. Larry would have had a few shortcuts. He and I would have figured out a few new processes. And even though there's a lot of framing coming, and we are a little antsy about you guys getting a little sick of it, we're just anxious to show you this roof system and see what you think about what we had to do to make it happen.
Yeah, the punchline or the teaser here, the roof, the rafters are made from the same type of material, TJIs, that those floor joists are at.
Yes.
So we have those big I-beams going from the peak down to the walls.
Yeah.
And I guess that's only the first part of it.
Yeah. And then the whole overhang all around the perimeter is false tails, free of heart, 4x8s, planed down to 3 1/8 by 7 1/2 that project to create the appearance and reality of an old school Craftsman 4-foot on center rafter overhang. It looks really awesome.
So back in the day, they would have done that with, and the 4x8s would have just ran all the way up to the top.
All the way up, yeah.
And they would have done it with tongue and groove all the way up as well, and would have cost a lot of money if we did that.
Yeah.
Probably possible. How long can you get 4x8s?
Not that long. Not as long as that main span.
Yeah.
You know, 22 feet plus a 3-foot overhang, 25. You can get them, but each one would cost as much as a real nice television, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this will be, if you watch this whole series, you're probably never going to build a house quite like this, but it will be very easy to understand how a more simple house would have been assembled. It's not totally on another planet from the way the rest of the houses work. It's just, we just kind of are torturing ourselves more than anything.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. The comments on YouTube, the comments on the second channel, EC2, are the best place to leave feedback. And we'll put a couple links in there to the Larry Hahn videos in case you haven't come across those yet. If you got specific questions or feedback, that's the spot. And thank you for listening and for kind of just supporting us. Lots of positive and helpful and energizing comments there for us as we do our best putting this type of content out.
Thanks.